And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 15th of December, 2023. How are you all keeping? I hope you're very well indeed. And we're looking forward to have you on board for the next 3 hours in the 9 to noon show. Of course, throughout the day here in Highland Radio. Our Friday panel, I'll introduce them to you in a moment. We've got a lot to discuss, lots of topics, and we want your involvement as well. 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts to that number, or give us a call on 074 91 25,000. If you prefer to email, it's comments@highlandradio.com. You can watch the show as well and see our guests throughout the morning. YouTube, on your smart TV or Fire Stick, just type in Highland Radio Ireland. We are there and we're live. And we're also across your mobile devices on YouTube and Facebook. Good morning to Elaine, Linda, Annie, Dolores, Marie, and already amongst those already with us this morning. Okay, our Friday panel is two-thirds of the way there, but it will be full before too long. I want to say good morning first to Deputy Padraig McLaughlin. Good morning, Padraig. Thank you very much for joining us. Of course, everyone knows Sinn Féin Chief Whip and spokesperson on fisheries and the marine. How are you keeping? No, you can't. Oh, I'm muted. Here we go. 1 second. I was the one that was muted. You can hear me now, Padraig. Can you?
Kennedy, thanks, Greg.
Yeah. You want to hear the introduction I gave you. It was a bit controversial, potentially libelous, but sure, you can listen back in the podcast. I'm only joking. Good morning, Professor Pat O'Connor, Professor of Sociology and Social Policy at University of Limerick. It's great to have you on the show again.
Good morning, Greg.
And we'll be joined shortly by Deputy Marion Harkin, who's connecting in as we speak. Deputy McLaughlin, I might start just listening to the news there and just, a sense. I don't know if it's a sense or it's just a bit of politics or what have you. Is the West's backing of Ukraine starting to wobble a little bit? We have Hungary blocking the potential money from the EU. Zelensky seems to be struggling to sort of get both sides of the house in America on board. And I suppose in terms of headlines and international events, we have the situation in the Middle East quite dominant. We're heading into a bad time of the year for any war. War's bad at any time of the year, don't get me wrong. But I just wonder, is the West wobbling in its support of Ukraine? And I note too also, sorry for the long-winded intro, but the Russians seem to be doing quite well. They seem to have plenty of money to fight this war. President Putin, obviously he's going to rig the election, so he's back in next year. Things seem to be going their way. Have you any thoughts on that, Padraig?
Yeah, clearly you're into, I suppose, what was going to be inevitable, a war of attrition along the fronts of the territories that the Russians have captured. And it's heartbreaking, the amount of lives that have been lost on both sides. It's into hundreds of thousands, as I understand, on both sides, and God knows how many civilians and people who are maimed for life. So I think from the perspective of the international community, both sides, obviously from the Ukrainian perspective, they want the Russians completely out of their territory, including Crimea that they annexed, I think it was 2013, 2014. And the Russians want to retain. So there needs to be clearly efforts to bring this conflict to an end, to find an acceptable solution. Obviously, what would be desirable internationally is if Russia withdrew from all the territories that they have captured in Ukraine. It doesn't look likely that's going to happen. So there needs to be negotiations to find a settlement.
And do you believe that that settlement inevitably is going to have to mean that, and I suppose in any settlement there has to be negotiation or, agreement from either side, but do you think it means inevitable that Ukraine is going to have to discuss some of its territory that it claims remaining under Russian occupation?
Well, the unfortunate situation is that, and my own, and I think most people in the world would prefer if Russia and Putin withdrew from the territories that they have captured. They are sovereign Ukrainian territory, and they should withdraw. But unfortunately, it doesn't seem that's going to happen anytime soon. Putin and Russia have dug their heels in. Obviously, the West and the United States, but there's not unity across the world. Mm. There's a lot of cooperation with Russia in the developing world, obviously in China, you know, Africa, South America, and they're not isolated across the world. So I just don't know how sustainable it is to have this war of attrition with huge numbers of lives being lost, particularly now increasingly on the Ukrainian side. It's a desperate tragedy, and I think the world needs to look at it again and try and resolve it.
And Professor Pat O'Connor, it is a war of attrition on the battlefield, but also for the minds, I think, of the West, and even the displacement of Ukrainian people across Europe. That is, Paul, all part of the Russian artillery, so to speak, because, you know, they know, they're aware, and Putin said it very, very early on, that it sort of starts, you know, adjusting how people might think. As I say, you know, politically in America, it's holding up funding there, and the same now is happening in Europe. Do you think that we are edging closer to a point where there is going to have to be a negotiated settlement, and Ukraine are going to have to ease up on some of their demands?
I think absolutely. In a way, I think the eyes of the world has moved from, whether we like it or not, the Gaza situation, Zionist Israel's action have totally taken the spotlight from Ukraine and Russia. I think even at the moment, giving up Crimea won't be enough for Putin. Putin sees the whole area as part of Russia. And the fact that they have been winning more than losing recently is posing a problem in terms of it. Zelensky has almost overplayed his card. And I saw him at the inauguration of Loco, the crazy president in South America, and I think that's going to, people are going to think, hello, if he's, you know, in a way that's going to undermine his credibility. So I think it's a very serious situation. I think the fact, I don't think Putin is in the mind, is willing to compromise even at this stage. So I'm kind of, I'm pessimistic as to what is going to happen. But I think certainly Crimea is gone, and it's only a question of how many other areas that Russia will hold.
It is kind of interesting too, in that, you know, you would have thought that if America said jump, Israel would say how high, and you would also have thought maybe that of the Ukraine leadership, but they seem quite dogged in their approaches regardless. But I mean, obviously the Ukrainians are far more reliant on Western funding. Marion Harkin has joined us now. Deputy Harkin, we were just talking there as it was on the news, that is, that, you know, is the West's support of Ukraine waning, the public support, for all the reasons Pat and Porg have been outlining, in terms of, you know, there's other things, top of the news bulletins and what have you. Do you think we're in a situation where Ukraine is going to have to start discussing what it might accept as a way to ending this?
That may be been over by what's happening in Gaza, those awful scenes that we can barely look at, and people's energy, a lot of it is concentrated on how can we stop this war, what efforts can we make, and it's good to see that Ireland is leading the way there. But to come back to your question about Ukraine, yes, because of that, it has been, if you like, knocked off the headlines. But obviously, it's back in them again with the EU Council meeting, and they got half their cake, if you like. They got their accession negotiations opened with the EU, but then a veto on the funding. And it's hard to know which is the most important. At one level, to open accession negotiations with the EU was hugely, hugely important for Ukrainians. I remember when I was in the European Parliament, and Porrig might have met some people as well, after 2013, many groups came to the European Parliament at that time, and they were very, very anxious back then, that's 10 years ago, that we could start negotiations.
But the big problem there, was it not, and you would know better than I would, is the level of corruption and governance in Ukraine. That would have been one of its biggest blockers to joining the EU. Has it been rid of that?
I actually don't know the detail of that. I haven't followed it at that sort of a granular level. But they, in order to open negotiations, certain requirements would have to be met. But now It's where, if you like, the rubber will hit the road, and the detail of its governance, its various systems, its justice system, any corruption that's there, that will now all come under the spotlight. And we remember this when a number of other countries joined the EU, that was an issue also. And it was often one of the last ones that the EU was withholding money from Hungary because of its efforts to influence its judiciary, because the fact that there wasn't proper media freedom and that certain groups were being targeted. So this is an ongoing issue, but definitely Ukraine would have a lot of work to do, because you can't join the EU without having all of its laws in place and implemented. So that's a long way away, but it's more the optics here. Mm-hmm. I think it's more the sense that Ukraine has taken the first on a pathway that gives a level of energy to people from Ukraine, because at the end of the day, you have to take the first step. But of course, the denial of the 50 billion aid package is a severe setback, and I'm not quite sure where the summit will go on that today.
Okay, JP McManus is donating an incredible €1 million to every county. In fact, some have already received it in Ireland. It's for grassroots investment in all codes of Gaelic games, with the association thanking the businessman for a remarkable gesture of support. Now, there's been a bit of a pushback on this. Some people think it's fantastic, but others say, hey, you know, Mr. McManus, you're a tax resident in Switzerland. You're incredibly successful. Perhaps maybe some of that money should be paid to the exchequer here, and it would be the government that might decide how that is spent. What's your view, Professor Pat O'Connor? Are you applauding Mr. McManus from the rafters, or do you have a different point of view?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, I'm very glad that Mr. McManus has specified that it should be spent equally on girls and boys, because this is a little problem that nobody seems to notice much. So at least that shows a degree of gender awareness. I am kind of, I have some sympathy for the attitude that it's easy to do Santa Claus. It's providing the basic whatever is that, you know, basic healthcare interventions on behalf of the disadvantaged, income support, etc. That kind of bread and butter stuff garners far less plaudits than, you know, money to the GAA. So I'd be a bit critical. I believe he has said he has not, well, years ago he said he was not a tax exile in Switzerland, that he just happened, his business happened to him. Be located there. I don't really know if that is true or not. But I mean, in a way, people are entitled to give gifts, and the way it behoves the receiver to be grateful. But I do think that there's been a bit too much hoo-ha about it, and so I'm sitting on the fence on this one.
Well, Pat, if you give me €1 million, you'll never hear the end of the hoo-ha, but I take your point. Deputy McLaughlin, have you any issue with this?
Yeah, I'm a bit like Pat. I'm torn on it. I mean, listen, obviously I love the idea of Donegal County Board getting €1 million to spend equally amongst boys, girls. I think it's also hurling, football, yeah. Camogie, it's equally. So, of course, I love the idea of that. Like, that's especially this time of year. But yes, I mean, if every single person who's liable for tax, you know, decided to do that rather than pay it into the exchequer, we'd be in serious trouble in the country. So I am torn on the issue. And I'm not going to speak out against my county and all the other counties. God knows, like, we love our...
You'd love him to be in this country taxing the ears off him, wouldn't you?
I would like everybody who's from Ireland to pay their taxes in Ireland and make the equal contribution. If we start to wear that down, we're going to be in serious trouble. That would be my preference. But, you know, listen, JP McManus is a very smart man. He's made donations to all sorts of worthy causes in Ireland. You know, very, very smart. And this is a very popular decision. And I'm not going to have a go at the man, but I would prefer if everybody label.
Why aren't you, though? He's kind of insulated himself from criticism in it because, you know, you if you, and I'm not saying you're not saying what you feel, by the way, I'm not suggesting that for a second, but I mean, it wouldn't be a shrewd political move either to say, you know, this is money we shouldn't be accepting here. This is money that should be paid off his profits and off his wealth into the exchequer, and it's up then to the government to, you know, I could sort of say, I don't like, if you say, for instance, Sinn Féin comes into power and it were me, I could say, I'm not paying tax in that country. I don't like Sinn Féin's policies. I'll move to Switzerland and I'll decide what I spend my money on.
That's the conundrum, Greg, you know, and you're not wrong. So I mean, you know, you had it with Dennis O'Brien, who would have paid for, I think it was Martin O'Neill, was he? Was it, or maybe it was Trapattoni, the manager of Ireland. Maybe it was both of them, actually. And their wages were paid by Dennis O'Brien through the FAI. So this is not the first time this has happened. And it is very popular with our sport fans, with our people, but it's not a great way to run the country, if we're being honest.
Marion Harkin, do you have a view?
I do, in, first of all, in the sense that we have a number of tax exiles here in Ireland. So maybe we need to look at that issue, because anyway, we could clean up our tax legislation. Because if money is made here, then really tax is made here. That's how tax would work, at least. I don't have strong views around this. I do know that in Limerick and the surrounding area, J.P. McManus is, as they say, very well got, because, as Cormac said, he has given a lot of money to a lot of different UL, for example, in Limerick, and a lot of other sporting facilities also. Look, for every club in Sligo, there'll be the guts of, I think, 30,000 per club. In Leitrim, I think it's around 28. It'll be less than Donegal, perhaps, you know, how much, I'm not sure. I just didn't hear that figure. You have a lot more clubs. But even in the likes of Dublin, they'll be getting around, I think, 2,500 per club. Some of the things about it are good, all sports included, both to girls and boys sport. So, you know, a lot of the boxes are ticked.
We haven't really said anything for the last 5 minutes, though, have we, Pat? Maybe you're not seeking election, but we haven't really said anything. We've sort of said, yeah, some people have some views, some people have another. I get it. You know, we can't sort of throw the 32 million back at him, but my God, he should be paying tax here, Pat. Isn't that what it comes down to?
And it is worth reflecting on the proportion of his income that this represents. I mean, for the proportion of tax, you know, people pay tax and it's, you know, the proportion of their income that goes in tax, this is 0.000 something of his income. So clearly, it's really not a big amount in terms of what he can afford.
But on the ground, it's big. And people love him. People, he's one of those types of people that people love. Right. Caller says, is Marion Harkin sorry, do you want to say one more thing, Pat? Go ahead, please.
I do think it's interesting and gender the fact that he could have funded, for example, refuges for women who are fleeing domestic violence. He could have funded childcare, right? Both of which he could have funded home health. So in a way, like, it is a particularly niche area that is overwhelming.
But that being said, he does have a background in sport. Those other things you talk of really are almost specifically the responsibility of a government. And this is sort of helping an amateur association that does actually, I think it gets what, is it 50 mil it gets from the state anyway, from us. It's certainly a tranche of 24 or more. But so is that a fair comment? It is, of course, a fair comment.
Comment, but it is also pointing out that it is a very, like, it is sort of like funding a luxury item as opposed to a basic whatever, you know.
I know, so what you're saying.
There's a bit of, but gifts by their definition, you know, are at the discretion of the giver. But so it's up to the government really to find a way of closing down loopholes so that money that is, this doesn't happen, you know.
Right,
so that is earned through Irish people is paid in tax at home.
All right, stay right where you are, please, Professor Pat O'Connor. And we also have Deputies Marion Harkin and Padraig McLaughlin. More from them after this quick break. There was a very well-attended meeting in Ballyshannon last night following reports that 90 male international protection applicants are to be moved into accommodation in Cavan Garden just outside Ballyshannon. It's a rural area on the south north side of Ballyshannon. Familiar concerns have been expressed over how these men will occupy themselves, access to services, jobs, security in the local area, and so on. Marion Harkin, I'll come to you first, Deputy Marion Harkin, because it was you really, I think, that brought this information into the public domain, and we did hear from you already in the week as to your motivations for doing so. I'm not sure if you were at the meeting or if you got any reports from the meeting, but I know it was wedged. And as I say, the concerns are familiar concerns that we're hearing right across the country.
Yes, I did attend the meeting last night. You're right. We're in Cavan Garden about 8:05. The meeting was 8:00, and I couldn't believe the number of cars that were there. A lot of people, the place was absolutely packed. And a lot of concern there. I suppose the first issue was that there was no notification, in the sense of no community engagement team, no consultation. And that's why, as soon as I got the information, I put it in the public domain. Well, you know, when the information comes to public reps, that's the purpose of it anyway. And I had seen elsewhere where no information was given to communities, in Boyle, for example, in County Roscommon, and there was a great deal of anger about that. So the meeting anyway, as you said, was wedged. There were a number of issues raised last night. First of all, Barry Sweeney, a local councillor, had been in contact with the family who actually owned the building, and he said that the family told him that they hadn't signed any agreement or contract. Now,
but do they not have that lease to a third party, no?
They do. So what the agreement is there, I don't know. Whether they signed it over to the third party and the third party can proceed or not. I really, to be honest, I don't want to speculate on that, because I didn't speak to them, and I wouldn't like to put words in anybody's mouth. But Barry Sweeney, you know, gave the impression, the strong impression, that the family who owned the building had not signed the contract, and the impression.
Yes, but just to be clear on that, is that effectively saying that maybe this deal is not done, or is that just saying it's not this local family's fault, so don't be getting on to them? Do you know what I mean? What is the purpose of that information?
To me, and this is my interpretation, and remember this is third hand, but to me the interpretation was that this deal, as laid out by the department, would not go ahead. But I can't guarantee or say that. I didn't speak to the family, and that doesn't mean that what was said yesterday mightn't be changed or might be different today. Really, they would have to speak themselves on this. But definitely, most definitely, it was introduced as a very significant issue by Barry Sweeney on the night. So, look, there was a lot of anger at the meeting, but equally, you know, you have to judge every meeting, not just by the loudest voices, but also by the numbers of people who don't say anything and maybe who speak to you afterwards, etc. But I think without exception, there was huge concern at the meeting.
Just in relation to that, I mean, and let's, you know, just put all our cards on the table, and it remains to be seen if this goes ahead before I bring our other guests in. There's very little, I presume, if there was a public meeting in advance, do you believe there are any reassurances that could be given that would not lead to the public going, this is inappropriate, it's not the right place, we don't want to hear. So we talk about, you know, pre-consultation in advance. But if the truth be told, Marion, you've been at this a long time, as we all have, there's nothing could have been said in advance, really, where the local community go, right, let's suck it and see.
I think, looking at last night, large mood boom. As for example, there were people there from Bundoran. There was one man there who spoke about, I he, again, I'd be quoting a figure somebody else used, but certainly well over 1,000, maybe 1,200 refugees in Bundoran, a lot of accommodation taken up. According to this man, business has collapsed. There's no tourism business. People are not coming to Bundoran. And there was a lot of anger and annoyance.
And we've heard that from a local publican, Dermot Doherty, I believe, in the past. Okay. I'm not sure if your phone's sitting on the microphone, but just when you begin to speak, it breaks up and then Zoom sort of seems to fix it after that. But anyway, I'll come to you, Deputy Pádraig McLoughlin, you know, as another elected representative. We've spoke about similar situations in other areas. You understand, I presume, the local concerns, but do you also understand that the government has its responsibilities and has to put these people somewhere?
Yeah, the difficulty is that you've always had, you know, asylum seekers, and they were in the direct provision system, and there was lots of problems with that. But what's really changed everything is the influx of Ukrainian refugees. There's 100,000 Ukrainian refugees now in the state. 60,000 of them, at least 60,000, are in state accommodation, and it's created a profound crisis. It appears to me that Roderick O'Gorman, the minister, has been isolated. He's getting very little support from other ministers, so his department are having to secure buildings. So if you're somebody who has a building or is opportunistic, in a lot of instances, you're going to make a lot of money from a system that has no plan. It's just wherever there's a building, we'll go there. And as you know, Marion says, I'm particularly concerned about South Donegal and Bundoran. Bundoran has built up a tremendous tourism infrastructure over many years, and indeed South Donegal as a whole. You know, that whole area, Donegal town, Bundoran in particular, out to, you know, obviously Slieve League, and you know, that does have to be protected. So my concern is just that the government doesn't appear to have a coherent plan.
Can I ask a question, though, just so, because I'd be very interested in your response, Pádraig, and I don't want to be ignorant and cut across you, but let's just say that we would agree with your party's position that there's been historic mismanagement of housing, that perhaps maybe we could have handled things up until now differently. So in other words, that you are answering questions based on your party coming into power now, right? So in other words, we will just presume for the purpose of the question that everything up until this point can be blamed on the previous administration, okay? So I think people are very interested in, especially as we come towards council elections, to find out, from here forward, having inherited this mess, or however people might describe it, what would your party do differently? Okay, so are you saying that your party, having inherited this, would not be seeking to put 90 international protection applicants into this accommodation in Cavan Garden if that accommodation wasn't available? And if you wouldn't put them in there, then where would you put them?
Yeah, well, let's just start with the process, okay? So somebody comes to Dublin Airport or for whatever routes they get into the country and they come and seek international protection. Right now, we have a situation where the system just is too slow. It's just too slow. It takes far too long. So under international law, we are required to process an application. It takes too long, way, way too long. Then the people who are refused stay. It appears.
So you would make sure that they are deported instantly.
So you start.
For instance, if someone rips their passport up in the toilets on the plane on the way over, because we know they have to have documents getting on the plane, right? And I'm not saying this is the norm, but it certainly happens. Are you saying at that point then you would actually send them back, or would you take them in and process them?
Well, what we do know is this, Greg, is that if you assess the current pool, which is I think around 26,000 asylum seekers in state, men, women, and children. We know that about 20% of them come from what are termed safe countries. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of them will not be granted asylum in Ireland. So why are you pooling this very large cohort from safe countries with people who, you know, for example, could be from Afghanistan? I think we all accept Afghanistan is not a country that you'd want to live, you know, and that. So that there's a big problem straight away. And that means that genuine asylum seekers, people that we would want to help, are on the streets as we speak.
So you'd get tough on asylum seekers coming into Ireland that aren't fleeing What about coming to Afghanistan? You can't fly directly into Dublin from Afghanistan. Would you say, right, well, you have to stay in the first safe country that you arrived in, or would you be happy enough that they go to a safe country and then decide to hop over to Ireland? Is that something needs looking at?
Well, I think we have to examine all of that. The system we have right now is not working. That's number one. Number two, the whole issue of Ukrainian refugees is way beyond what... I mean, this is not a lack of empathy, because, I mean, there are 7,000 Ukrainian refugees in Donegal. There are 1,500 asylum seekers in Donegal right now. Donegal is the highest per capita intake in the entire state, so there's no lack of empathy. But what we do not have is accommodation. You know, we have a housing crisis. We have a defective block crisis, mostly in North Donegal. You know, so that is the reality, you know, of what we face. So we need to look at the Ukrainian refugee issue. We really need to look at that and the asylum seeker issue.
Do you think your party needs to articulate this better at a national level to actually say this is the alternative then? This is what we would propose. Because, you know, in terms of every other area of policy or a lot of other area of policies, we have a working document or what you would propose. Like what you're saying is to a lot of people listening, go, right, that sounds all right. But what is the national Sinn Féin policy in relation to this? Is that clear? Is that there? What is the alternative program for government in this area? I mean, if that were put out into the public domain, I think it would be very useful for an awful lot of people out there.
Yeah, no, that you're not wrong. And we face, obviously, a European and local elections now in June 2024. There probably will be a general election later. So you're right, Sinn Féin need to define in our manifesto. But what I'm outlining to you today is our party's approach. And it will be very clear, as people say, when they're going to vote, these are my, you know, it's health, housing, my concern around these issues. Everything that we are offering.
You see, in the elections, this is the reality, I think. It's going to be immigration, health, housing. I don't think it's going to be the reverse of that. And then people will try and say, yes, but they're all interconnected. But I just have a feeling that this is what the big engagement is. Professor Pat O'Connor, thanks for your patience. Very interested in your views on this as well. More generally, if you prefer, or rather than the specifics of Ballyshannon, it's completely up to you, Pat.
Well, I don't know enough about the specifics of Ballyshannon, but, I mean, the issues are very similar. I suppose the one point that hasn't come up so far is that there is a particular community fear, I suppose, of men hanging around, right? I think it is hanging around is the problem. And that in a way, if people are seen to be actually doing things, either voluntarily or getting involved in the community, or simply, for example, joining sanctuary runners or whatever, this dissipates this fear. I think it's obviously totally unrealistic to think that men who are coming to an area have to be vetted. Like, I mean, nobody vets people who, you know, move from the country.
Yes, but Pat, in relation to that, right, I've never been vetted, but at the same time, there's access to potential records, you know, you know what I'm on about, whereas it is a case, now I'm not, I try and be very moderate in relation to this, but what people are saying is the vetting thing has become a catch-all. Someone's are travelling in from another country, often without documentation. They're questioned and fingerprinted, I get that, but that's not vetting. And then they arrive in an area, and it quite literally could be Charles Manson. You know, I know that's a complete exaggeration, but that's where the vetting thing comes from.
But I suppose, I think we have our own criminals, rapists, etc. But I suppose I think the one thing I think is a problem is the fact that as I understand it, that international asylum seekers cannot work for a minimum. They cannot be involved in any activity for a minimum of 6 months.
That's it. They can start working after 6 months. They get a PPSN number.
That is 6 months hanging around. And even, you know, people don't, for various historical reasons, and because most violence is committed by men, whether they're international asylum seekers or locals or whoever, people, many women, are intimidated by gangs of men hanging around.
That's
the
true. But they see another part of the problem is there is not work available for people in Ballyshannon and the Cavengard is really quite a rural area. And in this country, if you're 6 kilometres outside of a town, you know, you might as well be 100 kilometres outside of it too, unless you have, you know.
But I do wonder why, for example, the country is falling down with derelict buildings.
Yeah, but you see, that how long have we...
This is thinking outside.
I know, but the problem I have, Pat, is I've done so many new initiatives to bring the derelict building stock back into use. Like, I don't even do them anymore because nothing ever comes from it. Deputy McLaughlin, can you answer the question? If people coming here get a PPSN number after 6 months, right, and they are refused, and they're asked to leave, but they don't... Do you know if that PPSN number is revoked from them? Because I asked Deputy Harkin earlier in the week, and I'm not sure if she was sure. I believe she was not. Do you know that? Say, for instance, if someone is saying, right, you are not getting... you can't stay here. Is that PPSN number revoked, do you know? Or do they actually not get sent home, still have that number, and just batter on as normal?
I don't know is the answer, Greg, but I suspect that it isn't, because there are a very large number of people who have been officially deported who remain in the country. There's no tracking, it appears. This is one of the big problems. I mean, we need a fair and efficient system. There are people who are genuine asylum seekers, and every country in the world has an obligation in that regard. But the difficulty is now the system is sluggish, it's slow. If you are refused, it appears you're not sent back safely to your home country. And I think nobody can stand over that. So that's something that you start with the basics. You have to get that sorted urgently. And the reason why, you know, people are allowed to work after 6 months is because it takes so damn long to process these applications. That was an issue. Like, I met asylum seekers years ago when I was a chairman of an Oireachtas committee, and they'd been here for, 10, 11, 12, 13 years.
Yeah, which is why that was introduced, and I think it's sort of, that's why it was brought in, but now it sort of almost has a different purpose in that you can come here and start working in 6 months, while it was more introduced. It didn't make sense that people were... Did you want to come briefly in on that, Marion, before the break?
Yes, I did, because there's a few issues there. I spoke yesterday to Michael McDowell, and he said when he was Minister for Justice, they organised 3 flights to deport people. And he said, apart from the massive cost involved, he said one of the flights was supposed to have 60 people. He said 12 turned up. He's, you know, deporting people is extremely problematic. And I won't say it's impossible to do, but it's, you know, the issue is about people accessing the country in the first place. And what we now have is we have mass migration. And some of that is people looking for a better life, for leaving a country that's quite a safe country, like Georgia, for example, but just wanting other opportunities. And but then claiming asylum. And that really needs to be dealt with. And, you know, one of the suggestions I've heard recently, because you have to look at, you know, it's one point thing to describe the situation, but it's an entirely different matter to propose how you deal with it. And it isn't easy. But one of the suggestions that I've heard recently is, you know, when you put your passport down, let's say you're leaving Charles de Gaulle in Paris and you put your passport down, and that information should immediately be relayed to Dublin, to wherever the flight is arriving, and then they know who has passports leaving Charles de Gaulle. Well, obviously everyone
does. You have to have one.
Yeah, I know that, but we're told, you know, we've been told before, oh, people don't have travel documents, whatever. You can't get on a plane without travel documents. And if people get rid of them, they do that deliberately because they know that they will get in and that it'll take a long time to process. Now, it is much faster than it was, but the issue is that once people come into Ireland, then very many of them stay, and we actually don't know what happens to those who are refused permission to stay. Mm. But the idea of maybe working immediately, that's a real problem, because we have a visa system where people can come from outside the EU to fill particular jobs. We need to really up our game on that. For example, we need truck drivers, we need construction workers. And what we should put a bit of energy into is ensuring that, let's say, people from, I'll just go back to Georgia again, which is a safe country. Their ambassador has been into the Dáil. He's told us that on many occasions, that those people can come legally through that system. Mm. But then you cannot say that the people who perhaps lose or destroy their passports en route could then have the same opportunity to work here, because then we'd have no system at all. Okay. So we need to look very carefully at what we do at our ports when people arrive without documentation. We need to separate those people in some way from those who have documentation, who are coming from countries that are war-torn and that can rightfully claim asylum. They're a separate group of people. And I just finish with this. The conventions we work under, forget about our requirements within the EU. We see now that many member states are rowing back on those. But the conventions we work under were written in the 1950s, and they were to deal with what happened after World War II, when tens of thousands of people were literally walking across Europe, barely with the clothes on their back. We have a very different situation now, where people can get on a flight in country A, stop off somewhere for a period of time, and or not, okay, maybe just on another flight, come to Ireland. And the system is not meant to deal with that. Mm-hmm. So we need to deal with it at European level, but we do need significantly to tighten up on people coming into Ireland and to segregate or split Understood. Those who are genuine asylum seekers from those who are economic migrants.
Yeah, okay. And the numbers we're talking about actually aren't really huge in the wider scale of things. You know, I mean, you would be forgiven for thinking there's 250,000 international protection applicants.
I think the issue
is growing,
there,
but it's not a... That we
have a lot of Ukrainians and that increased numbers very significantly.
No, of course that. Of course, but if you there is different arguments people make dependent on where someone comes from. And if you say, for instance, if we all talked only about international protection applicants nationally, maybe I'm wrong, but the number is not ginormous either. Okay, right, back with more after these. You can't go to America, Australia, New Zealand, Canada without being vetted, even England now. Where did we get this information from that other people aren't vetted? We need the same in Ireland. Well, I was saying that, you know, the general population isn't per se. Good morning, Greg. It should be easy to track them. Do you not need a fixed abode to get social welfare payments? Good morning, Greg. It's not that long ago we were all about protecting women walking home alone, but sure, let's bring in 91 single males that come in from countries that don't respect women. That will help, won't it? That's now we're sort of moving into a different bit of territory there, Pat, because we're sort of profiling people that because they come from a different country that they present a greater threat to women. Now, unfortunately, we know with the record levels of calls to childline services and to domestic violence services that we really don't want to take the eye off the ball as the internal problems we have with predominantly Irish white men as well either, Pat.
This is true. I mean, I'm not also ignoring the fact that people come from different cultural traditions. And of course, this is a challenge. But it's really not, I mean, we do have Marion Harkin's point that we have obligations to international asylum seekers, and we have skills shortages, do you know, in particular areas like, God, our caring system, our hospital system couldn't function without people coming from outside. And it is, in a way, recognising that both we need them in terms of skills and also that they have something to offer. But of course, there are challenges about assimilating any group with different cultural traditions. I'm not again saying that.
Yeah, and it is that there is a profile thing here, though, Porg, too, whereby, you know, where are the older people? Where are the women? Where are the children? But then again, the point was made to me that it's much easier for a young, healthy man to move than it might be for, you know, different demographics.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a huge issue with communication here. I get exasperated because when we check and we find out that, I mean, certainly I agree with everything Marion said about the documentation, passports, checking through airports along the way. I agree with all of that. The system is really poor. But when you come here to get international protection, you're photographed, you're fingerprinted. There is a check in the European crime database. I mean, if you say boo to a goose, you're out of the country. I think that the real issue is, leaving aside that comment that came in, that I can pick up is the frustration around local services. Mm. I mean, you struggle to get to see a GP anywhere in Donegal, right?
That's what the absolute majority of people are concerned with, if the truth be told, that the services are at capacity. Unfortunately, we've had such an engaging conversation that we have to move it on. But Marion, I think it's quite interesting that listening to both you, Porrig, and Pat, or all three of you over the last while, 6 months ago, yous might have been labelled far right for what yous are saying. I think, and anyone can contradict me on that, don't get me wrong, but we're having, I think, a far more open and transparent conversation now where people realise it's not for those reasons. And I think that talks to the fact that we need to listen and speak to people rather than labelling them. None of you, by the way, do that. I'm not saying that's the case, but this is a far more productive conversation, I think, Marion.
Yes, I agree with you. And a lot of people were afraid to open their mouths because you'd run the risk of being attacked on social media and publicly if you raised any issue. And if obviously Porrig and myself would be in contact with people all the time and you hear what people are saying. And it is up to politicians to first of all, put forward their own policies so that people see where they're coming from and what they plan to do, but also to listen and to reflect what they hear. And, you know, I've had many, many conversations around the corridors of Leinster House, and I don't know that I've found anybody who disagrees with me, but equally, you know, when are we going to say it publicly? And 3 weeks ago on Leaders' Questions, I stood up, and I know it was not universally well accepted, but I asked the Taoiseach straight up. I said, you are the leader of this country. We need a conversation about migration. People need to know exactly.
No, we heard that. And
in
fairness to Deputy McLaughlin on this programme a number of months ago, he said something that certainly wouldn't be controversial now and wasn't terribly controversial then. And there was an organised campaign at that point to effectively have him cancelled because of what he spoke. But anyway, we've always tried to be able to, in respectful, constructive ways, we've had these conversations from the get-go on this show. Marion Harkin, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. Deputy Marion Harkin, have a lovely weekend too. Pat O'Connor, you know it's always a pleasure. I love having you on the show. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Greg.
And we didn't get to Sinn Féin in the polls. I was looking forward to sparring with you on that one, Porrig, but we might have to do that another day. Is that all right?
No problem, Greg. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Greg. Take care of yourself. All right. Thanks very much indeed. Okay, bye-bye. The news is going to be just a couple of minutes late as we bid farewell to our guests there. Back with more, including your comments after these.